Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you for subscribing to all those social media channels and for continuing to engage with us and refer us to new guests with new stories we've never heard before.
Hey everybody, if it's your first time, welcome. Really glad you found us today. I know I kind of sound like a broken record. I say that every episode. You picked the right one today. I've been excited kind of about guests in the past. We've had some great guests, some really interesting people. The one we have today is going to blow us all away. I'm a little starstruck, to be honest with you, and I can't wait to do the introduction here. This is going to be a lot of fun. And after you love the show, please go back and subscribe. Follow us. Look at the rest of our episodes prior to this one. And hit us up on social media. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, and what we can change.
Yeah, and there's, you know, just to echo what Bill said, there's some names in the service that just resonate, right? Like Thad Allen would be one.
Right.
This is one who we've got on the line now. You guys will, I think you're in for a treat, so stay tuned. Who we've got on the line, Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard, number 8, Vince Patton. Joined the Coast Guard back in 1972, retired after 30 years of honorable service in 2002. And served the final four as the Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard. We're going to change up our kind of a lineup from what we generally do. Usually, Bill and I, run down the bio. But Master Chief, after 30 years in the service, has we were going through it with him, and we're learning stuff from every tour.
The bio is a podcast.
The bio is its own podcast, really, with tons of dangerous and daring, and just some really cool facts that we didn't know before. So.
Right.
Welcome, Master Chief Patton. So happy to have you on.
Well, thank you, guys. Thank you so much for having me. And I'm excited. So I know you guys said you were nervous. Nothing to be nervous about, but I'll tell you, I'm really excited and really happy to speak with your audience as well as with you.
You know when you're starstruck and the star tells you don't be nervous, it doesn't work.
It doesn't help.
I'm still nervous. Yeah, it didn't help at all. Well, Master Chief, so I know, we'll start at the beginning. Where were you born and raised?
Okay, well, I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan. Number 5 child out of 10 kids, third boy. So I obviously came from a very big family, and I enjoyed my life. When you're from a large family, particularly a very close-knit large family, you didn't really think that you were poor or had any of those other kinds of things, because you had a lot of rich thoughts and the value of the people that you grew up with. So I had a wonderful life.
That's my daughter, the middle daughter, is going to be so stoked to hear that you were the middle child. And
right.
I mean, like, smack dab in the middle, too.
So it doesn't get more. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
You were the middle child.
It doesn't get more middle than that, Master.
There's hope everywhere.
There you go. Great. That's right. That's right. Well, the smart thing about being the middle child, at least for me, is that I think I was the smartest child, because my older brothers and sisters, whenever they got in trouble, I paid attention to that to know what not to do, or whatever they got caught doing, I knew how to not get caught.
Pro tip. Right. That's what we call that, a pro tip. Yeah.
Yep. I
love
it.
Life hack. I think that's a life hack. Yeah.
So you must have listened to somebody and joined the Coast Guard in 1972. Talk to us about that one.
Well, you know, I hate to make this a long story, so I'm going to sort of chop it up a little bit. But believe it or not, my whole interest involved in going the Coast Guard was really by accident, and it's a true accident. My oldest brother, who's 8 years older than I am, and the oldest of all of the 10 clan there. When he went into the Navy, I was 10 years old at the time. He graduated from high school, went into the Navy, and he sent me all these pictures home of him being in the Navy, all the exciting things he was doing in the Navy and so forth. And even one summer, I got to go visit him and spend a couple of nights at his unit. So I'm like stoked. The United States Navy was where I was going and what I was doing. I went into the Naval Sea Cadet Corps program, so I learned everything about the Navy. I was probably the most weirdest kid, because back then, in the late 60s, early 70s, the Navy had something like 460 ships. I memorized every one of them. If you told me a hull number, I can tell you what ship it was, what kind of armament it had, where it was home ported. I knew everything about the Navy.
I'm picturing you telling that to a recruiter, and I'd just be like, where are we going to put this guy?
well, here's what happened. You know, so the Navy was the only thing I had in my mind. I mean, when I was in high school, everybody knew I was going in the Navy. So on my 17th birthday, because this is all I talked about, my parents allowed me to enlist into the delayed enlistment program, because I was a senior in high school at the time. And so when I finished high school, then off into the Navy I would go. So my birthday fell on a Sunday, November 21st, 1971, to be exact. And so therefore, I had to wait a day before I got to go down to the Navy recruiting office. The next day, I beelined down to downtown Detroit to the federal building, and it was a long, narrow hallway, and I saw at the end of the hallway this second-class petty officer sitting at his desk on the telephone in the Cracker Jack blue uniform, and I made a beeline for the office. As soon as I walked in, he looked up at me and says, "Have a seat. I'll be right with you." And I got ready to sit down, and just as I got ready to sit down, I noticed the pictures on the wall. All the ships were white. And they said Coast Guard, not gray. I walked into the wrong recruiting office. Back then, the Coast Guard uniform was the same as the Navy uniform, with the exception of the hats. I paid no attention to the door, which was in big letters. It said United States Coast Guard. I just saw this guy sitting at his desk in a Navy uniform. I thought that was a Navy recruiter. So I'm too embarrassed to turn around and walk out, so I decided.
Typical. That is a rookie 18-year-old mistake.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm one day over 17 years old. You know, so I got to act like I'm cool. So I had to act like I didn't come in there by accident. So I kind of figured, okay, well, when the guy gets off the phone, I'll listen to him. Then I'll go find a Navy recruiter. So he's on the phone. He's talking, and I'm looking around the office. I'm looking at all kinds of stuff. I see this 44-footer jumping over a wave. I see an icebreaker with the penguin in front of it and so forth. I see all of these extremely cool pictures. And then I come across a unit citation that was hanging up on the wall, which one of the recruiters, who wasn't in the office at the time, was stationed on one of the ships that was involved in one of the Coast Guard's most heroic rescues, which I'm sure you all know, back in 1952. Where the SS Pendleton and the SS Fort Mercer were all caught up in the big nor'easter, and which of course the Disney movie The Perfect, the Finest Hours, was done on. So I'm reading this citation.
What a citation to put up in the office, right?
It's like, yeah,
we're still
going to
get them off.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was almost as if that was the most suckered way of getting you in the Coast Guard, to be honest with you.
Was it hanging right beside the picture of the 44 mess chief?
As a matter of fact, it was. Not that you know, no one's ever asked that question. But as a matter of fact, it was. It was. So I'm reading this citation, and I read it and read what happened, and this thing read like a doggone novel or script to a movie, which, of course, it later did become a movie. So I said, wow, as soon as I finished reading it. The Coast Guard recruiter stops his conversation on the phone, looks up at me, and says, I guarantee you'll have one of those in your first 4 years in the Coast Guard.
Boom. That's awesome.
Yep. And that's what did it.
That's good.
I never went to the Navy recruiter. Never even thought about seeing the Navy after that. So that's how I ended up in the Coast Guard.
And that's awesome.
That's where you proved you were the smartest out of the 10 children, because you joined the Coast Guard, not the Navy, Master Chief.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, you know, brother, you're telling your older brother, like, your pictures are cool, but they got nothing on us, right?
Well, you know, my oldest brother admitted to that. Years later, he said that to me, and he served a career in the Navy and actually became an officer and retired as a captain. But he said that to me years later. He says, yeah, you did the smartest thing. You know?
Yeah, you joined the Coast Guard and remained enlisted. You win. That's great.
True story. That's what happened.
That is great. So you signed the papers, and delayed entry probably took a couple months to get to recruit training. Did you go in Alameda, or was it already in Cape May?
It was in Cape May. I went to Cape May.
What time of year?
I went June 19th to be exact, 3 days after I graduated from high school. On June 19th, I reported to Training Center Cape May, New Jersey. And here's another funny story about that. When I got to Cape May, the bus pulls into the gate at Cape May.
I remember that part.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody, you're right. Everybody remembers that part. And here's why I will never forget it. The bus pulls in, and it stops after it gets in the gate, and then this guy gets on the bus wearing a Marine Corps uniform, and I mean a real Marine Corps uniform. He's a sergeant, had the drill sergeant hat and everything, and he starts yelling at us, and so we're all sitting on the bus confused, wanting to know, who the hell is this guy? You know?
Oh man, so, they took us to Paris Island. We're all gonna die.
So this guy sitting in the front row of the bus, who looked like the most nerdiest guy, and I'm not exaggerating. You know, black rim glasses, pocket protector, in his shirt. You know, he raises his hand and he looks at the guy and he says, "Excuse me, sir, you must be mistaken. We're here for the Coast Guard, not for the Navy." So, the Marine grabs him, throws him off the bus. I mean, just throws him off the bus. And so he looks at us and says, "All right, who's next?" And then we all just jump and run off the bus. We left our stuff on the bus and everything. We were all scared as hell. So what happened was is that the Vietnam War was winding down. And the Marine Corps had all of these Marines. They didn't know what to do with them. So they sent some of them to the Coast Guard and some to the Navy. So our forming week, our first week of forming week, we had this crazy ass sergeant, Sergeant Belair.
I knew you wouldn't forget it. I knew it was coming out.
I'll never forget that guy's name, Sergeant Belair. So this guy was crazy. You know. In fact, they were all crazy. But we had to deal with them for the first week of our forming week. And back then, boot camp was 10 weeks long. So, it was hell. I mean, you know, we were all cursing our recruiters. And like, "Hey, they never told us this," and all that stuff, And it slacked off a little bit after the first week, but not by much. We soon found out that our chief bosun mate was just as nasty as Sergeant Blair. And this is back in the days when they can catch you too. So this sergeant, he'd have this damn swagger stick and he'd beat you with it, that was a big experience there.
I can't imagine. Yeah, I mean, it's bad enough to see a guy in a Coast Guard uniform step on. I can't imagine when the Marine comes on. Yeah, it's over.
And even worse is, the guy in the front row says, "We're not here for the Navy." That really made the guy mad.
Oh man, that's epic.
Yeah.
So you do your 10 weeks, made it out. And then how do you decide on your rating, or was it decided for you?
Well, okay, here's another story I got to tell you about this.
I love that. I'm glad that we did the bio this time.
So 2 weeks into boot camp, this is to get to your answer here. So 2 weeks in the boot camp, as we're running around and so forth, and I was in the barracks, which is now called Monroe Hall. Yeah, back then it was called Barracks 267. So on the quarter deck, when you come in, was this giant painting. In fact, that painting is still at Cape May. We happened to see it there while we were in Cape May last week. So, and this big giant painting, it was a little confusing because, going back to when I told you I knew everything about the Navy, which of course translated to the Coast Guard as far as ranks and rates and so forth go. So I see this picture of what I think is a Master Chief. The guy has 3 stars, and I'm confused. Nothing in any of the stuff that I had looked at showed a Master Chief wearing 3 stars. I didn't know what he was. And so I go to my company commander, Seaman Recruit Patton, in week 2, goes to his company commander and asks the simple question, "Sir, there's a picture of what I think is a Master Chief on the quarterdeck, but he's wearing 3 stars. Who is he?"
I already know this is going somewhere. Seaman Recruit asked a question. Like, there's already 2 strikes.
This is moving towards push-ups, I feel.
Yeah. So my company commander, Chief Harvey Glenn Birch, BMC Harvey Glenn Birch, the very typical boaster mate of that era, gets right into my face and yells, "That's the Master Chief, Petty Officer of the Coast Guard." And I said, "Well, what does he do?" And then he gets back into my face and he says, "He tells the Commandant what to do." he said that calmly. And there were some other words that went in there, he tells the effing Commandant what to do, So I'm still a little confused because my Coast Guardsman's manual did not show this guy with 3 stars, because at that time the position was very new, so we didn't have it in our Coast Guardsman manuals. So anyway, I just kind of took what Chief Birch said as stock, and then went about my life in boot camp. And back then, we didn't know what schools that we qualified for until we were almost done with boot camp. So it was week 8.
Man, those recruiters were good back then, weren't they?
Oh, yeah.
They got you guys.
Well, but you got to remember, they had Vietnam in their favor, too. So, they had more people coming in. They didn't care what they did in the Coast Guard, Except a few of them found out later they were going to Vietnam,
Yeah, and then they step on that bus and the Marine Corps recruiter comes out.
Yeah, so it wasn't until after week 8. It was somewhere in week 8, we get called out one at a time to go see our career counselor, who was a yeoman there. And he would sit down and he would say, "All right, these are your scores. This is what you can do." And by then you learned about all the different ratings in the Coast Guard, and you were able to give them an idea of what you might want to do or what you qualify to do. And he'll explain to you about how long the schools are, blah, 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 going to that. So this guy, and of course I'll never forget this guy's name either, YN2 Kurt Gunn. He later retired as a commander. So YN2 Kurt Gunn, he goes over it with me, and then I, Seaman Recruit Patton, innocently asked the next question: "What school do I go to become the Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard?" And he looked at me and he says, "Okay."
Oh, yep, that's the right answer.
And Chief Birch, my company commander, happens to be standing right behind me. And he thought I was being a smart ass. So he grabs me by the collar, yanks me out of the chair, pushes me out the door, marches me out to the middle of the parade field, the grinder as we called it back then, and tells me to get out and give him 50 push-ups. And I'm confused. I'm trying to figure out what, you know, what did I do? What did I say? So I you know, now this is August. It's hot, you know, and God knows what the temperature was. But if you've ever been to Cape May in the summer, you know it's pretty humid and hot.
Oh, yeah.
I do my 50 push-ups, snap back to attention, and then he looks into my face with this angry eyes, and he says, the day you become the Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard, that's the day I walk on clouds. And that man was so right, because he died 2 years before I became Master Chief of the Coast Guard.
Oh, man, yeah. Wow. A little foreshadowing, huh?
Yeah, divine intervention really happened.
Yeah, there it is.
So anyway, so the long story to that is that what did I do? So after the punishment of where he thought I was being a smart ass, you know, and I went back in to see YN2 Gun. He then went through my scores, and then he asked me about my life. And then when he found out that I knew Morse code, he kind of selected the school for me. I didn't even, you know, I actually wanted to be a corpsman or health service technician. Back then it was called hospital corpsman, but I wanted to do that. And but then he kind of selected radioman school for me, and that's okay, because I said, all right, I knew Morse code, and that was fine. So that's how I ended up being a radioman. And then after boot camp, and they were very much hurting for radioman, that I went straight to radioman school. I got to go home for about 8 days or something like that, and then off to Petaluma I went for 6 months of radioman school.
Which, 6 months? Wow, actually, what a course. Yeah, that's a long course.
Yeah, and it was it was actually, you know, a lot of fun, because most of it I knew, so I didn't feel like I was struggling in the course at all. I mean, I had to learn all of the different in military ways of doing things and so forth, but I was very good at Morse code, and was able to meet all of the, because the Morse code requirements were very, very tough, and the washout rate was tremendous there. I mean, we started with a class of 20, I think 8 of us graduated, and of the 8 of us that graduated, 4 of us were the actual original class. The other 4 came from other classes that were rephased, so it was a tough, challenging school to go to at the time. So
I'm thinking about Allied Visual Comms now. It's right. Like it's an online course.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, no, I was just thinking. Yeah, so, I was thinking of like every World War II movie you watch, where you hear the Morse code and some guy can hear it and like actually know what it's saying.
Right. Yeah.
But
yeah,
apparently, yeah, that's what they expected a Master Chief to actually be able to go, oh yeah, no, he said this.
We're now going to do the rest of the interview in Morse code. Good luck following along.
Well, believe it or not, I still know Morse. I'm not.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah, no, I believe it.
But yeah, when this starts coming out, I said, oh yeah, I perked up and I'm right there. I can still do it. It's a language. It's a language that, you know, if you've done it a few times, you'll never forget it. So it's pretty interesting.
It sounds like they beat it pretty deeply into your brain in that school mess.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, exactly.
And I remember you saying earlier you were the third class in Petaluma, so it was like, I mean, it was brand new out there, brand new facilities, I'm guessing, or maybe we inherited something old, I guess, maybe more than likely.
It was all inherited old, although radioman school was the newest of the old, because they took a building. I don't know what the building used to be, but they gutted it and redid it around. So we had probably the best, newest classrooms than anything else that was out there at the time. Everything else was all old Army stuff. Hand-me-down stuff, but it was down at the bottom of the hill. In fact, it was far away from, if you've been to Petaluma, you know, the compound was up at the top of the hill, and then there was an old building down at the bottom of the hill, and that's where radioman school used to be. We used to march down there about a quarter of a mile every morning and back up the hill at the end of the day, but it was pretty much state-of-the-art, at least at that time. Nice state-of-the-art stuff that they had.
Well, even that long ago, Master Chief, were people still like, why is the Coast Guard training in a cow pasture far from the ocean? Were they still like that?
Oh yeah. In fact, I thought it was a big joke. I remember when I when I got there, they were telling me how to get there, and you get to San Francisco and you take this bus.
Yeah, where are you sending me, right? I bet you're like, what is going on?
You start questioning it because you look on a map and see where Petaluma is, and then you say to yourself, well, maybe it's really out by the water, and they just use a Petaluma address. And then when you find yourself really out there, and you can smell the cow pastures, is this a joke? I mean,
you're in San Francisco, the maritime nexus of the Western United States, and then you just keep driving north, and all of a sudden, there's cow poop.
Exactly.
There's no
beautiful.
I haven't seen water for an hour.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Crazy. Oh yeah.
Imagine.
Yeah, and when you wake up in the morning, and honest to God, you wake up in the morning and you can hear the moo.
Yep. Oh yeah, and nothing's changed. It's still the same. That's great.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's too funny. So, Radioman Patton, RM3 Patton, where does he get assigned after school?
Well, after school, I went to the Coast Guard Cutter Dallas, which was at that time based out of Governor's Island, New York. And the ship did some interesting stuff, did some ocean stations. Way back when, ocean stations was, we always called them, going out to drill holes in the ocean.
Cut holes in the water, right?
But they were very, very important. I mean, it took, I think for us radiomen, we may have understood the meaning of an ocean station than most anybody else on a ship, by virtue of the fact of you were close to the operations, so you knew what was going on. And it was, doing oceanographic research, it was you were pivotal communications for aircraft flying across the ocean. Mm-hmm. And you remember, this is the early 70s, the satellites weren't even in existence back then in terms of sending your signals up the satellite. It was quite interesting. So like when transatlantic aircraft transit was going on, they had to do communications with you to get fixes and things like that. So we radiomen actually had busy work. I think of all of the ratings on the ship, I would say we had the busiest work. So it was pretty interesting to doing all of that. And then we got to play with the Navy and doing refreshers training stuff. We went down to Guantanamo Bay. We actually got to go all the way down to South America on a Navy exercise, and then we went. And then I just before I left the ship, we did a cruise over to South Africa, the West Africa training cruise with the U.S. Navy. So I got to do an awful lot of stuff that I didn't think that I'd ever get to do in the Coast Guard. I always thought of just staying close to the U.S. and that was it. But got to do a little bit more multiple things.
Yeah, that's a pretty wide range, all the way across the Atlantic, I would say, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like you said.
It brings me to a sea story to tell you.
All right, here we go.
Well,
all right.
You asked me, what was the Dallas? Dallas was a high endurance cutter, a 378, which are now being replaced by the new national security cutters. And as I see those national security cutters, I always wish if they were around at the time I came to Coast Guard, man, that was like living on a luxury liner, I tell you.
But
for its time, the Dallas was one of the newer ships, which when you compare the Dallas to some of the older ships that were of that size, we were really pretty much living large compared to like the Coast Guard Cutter Bib or the Spencer or some of the older ships that were still in existence at that time.
Well, yeah, and we had a guest, Joe Peterson, talking about like Coast Guard Cutter Comanche and stuff. I mean, those were World War II era ships.
Like our bases, hand-me-downs from the Navy.
Right.
Oh, yeah. This was one of the first ships that was really built with 100% specifications for the Coast Guard. And it was, at that time, it was like we really were living large as in comparison to what a lot of the old World War II era ships, which are mostly former Navy ships and so forth. But anyway, I got to tell you the sea story because that happened on the Dallas that sort of stays in my mind and it goes back to a promise that my recruiter made in the recruiting office. If you remember when I read a unit citation, and he promised me that within my first 4 years in the Coast Guard, I would have one of those. Well, he was so right, and I don't think he really knew that was going to happen. But
we've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 theme storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
While we were out on an OSHA station, we picked up a SOS call from a Russian trawler. Now, Russian trawlers back then were really spy ships because they had more damn antennas on them than they had fishing gear, but they went by trawlers, of course.
Right.
So, and we would shadow them often because, you know, when we'd see them, as long as they were outside the 200-mile fishing zone, that was fine and so forth. But we would shadow them a little bit. Well, we had actually come across this trawler a couple of days before, so we knew what the type of ship it was.
It's got to be something big for a Russian spy ship to start transmitting SOS, right? I mean, is that what
thinking
when you're in the watch? Yeah, you're like, this is real.
Exactly, exactly, because the first thing that happened, and I had to watch. I was on watch, and I had only been in the Coast Guard probably a little more than a year and a half at the time. And so I'm on the watch, and I get this SOS call. And, you know, of course, you know, in my panicky mode and responding back, and I contact the ops officer, contact the captain, you know, they all come run to the radio room to find out what's going on. My chief comes in, and everybody's standing over my shoulder while I'm wrapping Morse code back.
So this whole thing came in as like a ... Awesome.
Everything was on Morse code. It was not in voice at all. And because I'm dealing with the Russian ship, two issues. One is that the Russians typically were very fast on Morse code. They were just rapidly fast, and very few of us on the ship could keep up with them. And I happened to be one of them. And I think that I owe all of that in the fact that when I started radio school, I knew Morse code. I wasn't as fast then, but I became proficient during the time I was in radio school. And then while we were on the ship, I used to sort of play around and play with certain frequencies when I would catch the Russians sending various messages, and I would copy it and send it, you know, copy it just to keep up with it. So anyway, so we got this Mayday, and so I'm getting the information, and what happens is the captain on the trawler had been hit in the head with a tackle box, and was bleeding profusely out the ears and so forth, and they wanted a medevac. Well, because this is during the era of the Cold War, it wasn't, the Coast Guard couldn't quite just jump on this like we could do in any other cases. We had to get permission from the State Department, and so you got to send messages back to get permission. And by then, the captain ordered somebody else to sit on the other circuit to relay information back to the Rescue Coordination Center in New York, and then I would relay it back to whatever had to be relayed back to the Russian trawler. So
you know what's funny, Master Chief? Just thinking of that, I really don't think we've even sped anything up, even though we can talk to each other.
We can talk now, but it's no faster.
We might have actually made it slower.
Probably.
But, yeah, we just complicated it even more, because now we got to send imagery and recordings. The whole game.
Oh, you're right. You're right, because it is a lot different. Back then, it was just, you know, you get what you got and you had to work with it.
Yeah, you got dots and dashes, right?
Right.
Here you go. That's all I can give you. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other complicated part of this is that I'm doing Morse code with someone who doesn't speak English. So you resort to using what is called Q signals, which are three letter symbols, three letters that starts with a Q, and each of these three letters would translate to a sentence, sometimes a paragraph, of what it means. And I don't remember all of them anymore, but QRU is I have nothing for you. There's a whole bunch. So anyway, so I got to get these cue signals, and I've got to translate when I see what they are in order to give it to the captain or to the chief or to the comms officer, so they knew what I was saying and what they were saying to me. So it made it even more complicated, because now, you know, they said, well, tell them to find out what the guy's situation is. How is he as far as his physical condition and stuff like that. So first thing I got to do is look up some cue signals that translate what that means and then send it out in the cue signal. So, I mean, and this is all like rapid time. You got to do this back and forth. So, it was really something, especially given the fact that this was a life and death situation to deal with.
Yeah, and this is your moment. I mean, this is your first SOS as a radioman. Like that's
exactly.
Yeah, that's your moment right there. I mean, you gotta perform.
I'm just thinking about how much is going on here. Like you're using two different spoken languages, and then basically two different codes. Like you're taking this Q code, putting it and saying it in Morse code, and then he has to look and then see what it says. And I imagine you're flipping through a book the whole time you're doing this, right?
Yeah, Chief? Exactly. Like, yeah.
Because you're not pulling it up on the internet. It's not on the same
internet. Right. Yeah, you have to go to the bookshelf, pull the book off the shelf. Yeah.
Flip through the page. Yeah,
this book is about the size of a New York City phone book.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's got like, you know, several thousand combinations of Q signals, and the military calls them Z signals because there's a Z signal part. But when you're dealing with foreign or commercial, you use Q signals.
Right. And now we all go home when email goes down.
Oh yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So long story short, we after communicating in this manner for close to 5 hours or so, we get permission to go to the ship to get the captain and bring him back to New York, and which was a big deal, because all of a sudden, you know, now you got this concern that, you know, once you bring him onto a U.S. Vessel, a particular U.S. military vessel, and you know, the Russians are all kind of concerned that he's gonna tell some secrets or defect, and so they had to bring this other guy on the ship too, who was like the political officer. He didn't call himself that. He said he was just a deckhand, but we knew what he was, you know. So so we go back to New York, and in the course of all of this, I had to stay on the circuit the whole time. The captain did not want me to leave the circuit other than to go take a bathroom break if I needed to.
Well, yeah, he probably finally pulls up next to this Russian trawler. There's actually a captain bleeding, and someone's in distress. Right. And he's like, "All right, this guy knows what he's doing.
Patton can do his job.
Yeah, exactly. Patton's good."
Yeah, exactly. So I'm 19 years old when this happens, you know, and when we get back to New York, you know, and after all of the smoke clears and everything goes down, it finally hits me that wow, I did something. I was involved in this, I got a letter of commendation for it, for doing that. My first award that I ever got in the Coast Guard, and the unit got a unit commendation at that time. So, it was pretty cool. Like I said, the recruiter said, in your first 4 years, you'll get one of those. He was right.
And that's I want to meet some of the fortune tellers that you hang out right? with. You know what I mean? What can you guys tell me? That's good. That's awesome.
Yeah. So that was my true story, and happily it happened within my first 4 years in the Coast Guard.
Very cool.
That's a really cool.
Yeah,
sea
that
story.
Is a very cool sea story. Which is funny, because normally we talk a lot of smack on operation system specialists, which are kind of the counterpart now, right? But it sounds like it was much more complex than
it was much more complex than that.
Yeah, now is chat working?
Right. Chat's not working. Yeah, my chat's down. We gotta call it. Take the cutter in.
Yeah. Well, can you imagine if I had all of that, all those tools? At my disposal back then, goodness,
And with comfy like two-man berthing on the NSC, you're good to go.
Oh, yeah. I mean, goodness. You know, it would have been a lot. Goodness. Life would have been good. You know, the Russian guy comes back, says he can't speak, and he says, no problem. I turn on my Google Translator.
Yeah, right? Yeah, you can write it down. You can speak it. It doesn't matter. Yeah, we got you. That's good.
So that's what happened on the Dallas. And after I left Dallas, I went to Group Detroit, which is now today they're called Sectors, Sector Detroit. But back then it was Coast Guard Group Detroit, and in that definition of Group Detroit, it included the Coast Guard Air Station Detroit. So. So as a radioman, I would do some of my watches down at Base Detroit and some of my watches up at the air station. Actually, I think the way it worked was I would do one series of watches, like, you know, a morning and night mid-watch in Detroit at the base, and then the next series of watches I would do up at the Coast Guard Air Station, which was about 30 miles away. And that was pretty cool. So I really got to enjoy that.
And what was that, Master Chief? Was that like, that was what, about 1975 or so? What kind of airframes? What were they flying back
then? That
was
exactly, yeah, that was 1975, 74, 75. What they were flying back then were HH-52 Alphas, which were, I think they called them the Seahorse at the time, the helicopters before the Dolphins.
No swimmers back then, right? So they were landing, and then people were just getting pulled on board the helicopter directly.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. Those things were capable of landing in the water, and that's kind of what happened. That they would, the air crew person would be able to yank the person in. That'd be about it. But
your Coast Guard was so cool.
So I wasn't there very long. I'm stationed in my hometown, which I was really enjoying it. Life was good, and then I was there for about 9 months. And I come to work one morning. This is early 1976, and my chief says to me, "You got orders." And I said, "What do you mean I got orders? I had just reenlisted. I just reenlisted in the Coast Guard." And he comes and he tells me I got orders. I said, "What do you mean I got orders?"
Yeah, they knew they had you.
We got you now. Yeah, I'll send you wherever I want.
Yeah, you know, and I tell you, I was one of the most pissed off Coasties at this point because, the Coast Guard really screwed me in my viewpoint. So, my chief was, he agreed. He says, "Yeah, I think that this one, right?" We called headquarters to find out what happened. And so he told me, he said, "Well, the Coast Guard is selecting and directing you to go to Chicago, to recruiting office Chicago." And I asked, "Well, why didn't it put in for recruiting duty? Why do I want, I don't want to go on recruiting duty." And I didn't, because I was concerned. I'm a second class radioman now, working on making first. I just reenlisted. And I was concerned by going on recruiting duty, I'm being taken out of my rating and I'm not going to be proficient in it to compete for first class. And so I did feel pretty cheated on that. So what happened was the Coast Guard at that time decided to get very serious about minority recruiting. When I came in the Coast Guard in 1972, the number of African Americans in the Coast Guard was extremely low. In fact, the numbers were so low the Coast Guard didn't even tell what it was. It was estimated it was somewhere in the neighborhood of about 4%.
Estimated. It was a very small number. They didn't tell because it was so low, or because record keeping was so bad they honestly didn't know?
I think it was a little bit of both. Yeah, it was a little bit of both, because, you know, from the record standpoint, you know, when I remember when I did my paperwork, and I don't recall them asking me what color I was. I mean, you know, maybe they put it down or something like that. But then again, whatever went on the paperwork, who was back at headquarters keeping track of that? Probably nobody.
That was a totally different Coast Guard, yeah. Master Chief. I took a survey the other day, and it asked me my gender, and it was male, female, or custom. I mean, that's, you know, that's
custom.
New. Yeah, I mean,
went custom on that.
What do you write in? I don't know. I just thought it was interesting. You know, I'd never seen that before. That was new.
Oh, that's interesting. So, So anyway, I kind of went kicking and screaming about going to Chicago. And I mean, granted, I only went to Chicago. Close to 300 miles from Detroit. I shouldn't have been bitching and moaning that much about going there. But still, I looked at it as I was being taken out of my rating against my will. You know, they said, we're only going to be on recruiting duty for 2 years. So calm down. Go out, you know, do your job and that kind of thing.
Now, I'm going to ask you a serious question, Master Chief. So I know you're married, and I think you've been married for a long time. Did you meet her when you were back in Detroit?
No, I did not.
Okay. Well, hey, it was a valid question. I thought I was going to get a yes. I was like, yeah, that's why he's mad, because he met, right.
But I did have a girlfriend in Detroit at the time that, you know, that it might have turned out to be her.
Yeah, because you were back home. Yep, you're back home, right. Had money, you know, accommodation medal on the chest.
Good. Right.
Yep.
So I call the Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard's office. So this is the first time I ever engaged with the Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard to tell him that I was being screwed and I wanted him to do something about it. Well, the Master Chief of the Coast Guard at that time turned out to be he was a Master Chief Bosun Mate who was at Group Detroit just when I first got there, and he later became Master Chief of the Coast Guard. That's Hollis Stevens, Master Chief number 3. So when I call the Master Chief of Coast Guard's office to speak to Master Chief Stevens, because he knew me, and I told him what I called for, and he gave me the biggest tongue lashing. I didn't expect this from him. Right? You know, I expected him to tell me, yeah, you're right, you've been screwed, I'll take care of you. But he gave me the biggest tongue lashing in the sense of telling me, well, you know, you now have to do something for the Coast Guard. You just put a hash mark on. And so you're now part of the company, and the company needs you, and here's what the problem is, and you're going to do this. And I asked, well, did you have anything to do with it? He says, no, I didn't have anything to do with it. He said, what happened was the Coast Guard, when they looked at the number of minority recruiters that they had, out of something like 200 or so recruiters, only like 6 or 7 of them were minority, and nobody had put in for it. So they decided to look through people's records and pick out who was going. So you, first of all, you should be honored that you got picked to go. Secondly, you're going to go and you're going to do a good job. And he kind of
typical got on my case. That's what chiefs do. We put a positive spin on it, no matter what it was, right?
He did.
Let me give you some ketchup for this shit sandwich.
Yeah, he did. So I went to Chicago, like I said, reluctant. But it turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I got there and I got busy, and I started realizing that, you know, I came in the Coast Guard because I walked into the wrong recruiting office. And then I looked at a lot of people out there, regardless of what color you are, most of you don't even know anything about the Coast Guard, especially people of color. When talking to young African Americans and so forth, you know, they never thought the Coast Guard was even attainable for them. So that kind of changed my head a little bit about being involved. And so, as it turns out, I did my 2 years with a lot of thrill and enjoyment. And when I came off recruiting duty and headquarters was going to give me my promise to send me back to Detroit or any place I wanted to go, and I decided I want to change my rate. And
Master Chief, let me ask you one question before we move to the next one. What so you know, minority retention is still a major issue in the Coast Guard, right? What mm-hmm. what did you find? You know, it sounds like you were successful there. What tips mm-hmm. would you have for recruiters now? I mean, is there anything that you could relate from your success there that would you know, maybe be impactful now? I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, you know, here's two things that happened. One is, it was about exposure. My getting out there and getting into the communities, particularly where there were, you know, like in the inner city and so forth, and telling young African-American men and women that they can do what I did. And I actually had, a good story to tell. I told them a story about the responsibility that I had placed on me when I was on Dallas, and talked about the Coast Guard as a whole and what what we did and how, in my belief, that we are service above and a cut above other services. So as I translate that today, is the fact that overall, looking at what we do, our missions, our responsibilities that we do as a service, that we truly need to reflect what the population of this country is all about. And the fact is that if you don't see a lot of African Americans, you know the reason why you don't see a lot of African Americans? Because they haven't been exposed to understanding, and you have to be part of that. And I kind of took what Hollis Stevens said to me and turned it right into my recruiting pitch, and it became successful.
That's good. I'm glad you didn't say I just put up a bunch of signs for Navy and hope people walked in. You know, I was curious. I didn't know how it was going to go. That was so lame. I had to get that out there, though. I was thinking it.
So I left recruiting duty, and then I went from there to Chicago. I mean, to Cleveland when I changed my rate to Yeoman. Oh, when I changed my rate, as luck would have it or not have it, I just got to the point where I was making first class radio. And I wrote my letter to change my rate to Yeoman. And at the time, I didn't realize I was going to make RM1. So when the letter came back approving my change of rate, I had gotten also the advancement list cutoffs change, and I became eligible for first class. So the letter that came back from headquarters allowed my change of rate from RM1 to YN3. And partly they did that because they didn't want me to change my rate because they needed radio men. And so I really thought about it, and then I decided to take the reduction. People thought I was nuts. I can't, they couldn't believe I was going to do that.
I think you're nuts right now. Just listen.
It's a lot of money to give up.
What was the reason for the change?
Well, the reason had to do with what I did on recruiting duty, and it had everything to do with working with people and being involved with people. And that's something I didn't do early on in my Coast Guard career. And I started looking at, wow, if you're thinking about really wanting to stay around for the long haul. And I truly believe that one day I wanted to be Master Chief of the Coast Guard. I never let go of that dream that I wanted to do other things that involved me being involved with people and working with people. I felt that I had, as I looked at my future in the Coast Guard, that I felt I could do it better as a yeoman.
Yeah, so, that was the political way of saying I didn't want to just communicate with people through Morse code. I actually wanted to see people. I like that. Yeah, I like it.
Well, the rating was changing even then. That what I did on the Dallas, if I were to go back to the Dallas or any other ship after that as a radio man, it was going to be quite different because the introduction of computers were coming in and so forth. And you know, so it was changing then. So I think I made a good choice. In fact, when I took the reduction, the Coast Guard headquarters did give me the opportunity to. I took the reduction on the 1st of September of 1979, and then I was able to compete for the YN2 service-wide exam that September. And when I competed for the service-wide on that September, I was like number one on the list. So January the next year, I made YN2, and then I was able to take the March service wide for YN1, and I made YN1 January that following year. So all in all, it only cost me 16 months from the time that I took the reduction that I got first class back.
Yeah, so, that's a pretty good deal. I mean,
it was a risk, but I was able to do it.
I would expect that too, if you were coming in as an RM1 and then on the YN3 list, you're probably going to get promoted pretty quick. That's good.
Well, it was funny because I know when I went to Cleveland, all people knew was I got busted to third class.
Oh, right. Yep. Man, you can make up all kinds of lies about that.
People were all wondering, what did you do?
I killed a guy.
Yeah, you must have really screwed up. I thought that dot was a dash. Right. That's good.
So from Cleveland, you know, I worked in the district office there, and I was going to school on the side, which I didn't tell you this story. Partly is I came into Coast Guard right out of high school, and then after I came in right out of high school, and while I was on the Dallas, I was taking college correspondence courses, and I did it mostly because I was bored. I truly didn't really have a real inclination about getting a degree. And when I got to Detroit, Master Chief Stevens, who was the Master Chief Post made it thing, who was the command enlisted advisor, he encouraged me to continue with my education, which I did. And that's how I ended up getting my bachelor's degree while I was on active duty. So I continued on working on my master's degree while I was on recruiting duty in Chicago. And I earned my master's degree at Loyola University in Chicago. And when I got stationed in Cleveland, oh, I got to back up another story. Are we running out of time?
No. Hey, we will talk as long as you want to record. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, you got some strong chiefs, you know, like throughout your career, and then you getting out. I think people are going to benefit from whatever you got to say. Yeah. So carry on, Master Chief.
Oh, okay, good, because I your biggest mistake was asking me to talk. So.
No, we love it.
You're making our job easy, Master Chief. Yeah.
So I've got to back to when I was on recruiting duty, and this is what also kind of adds to the story a little bit. So when I was during my time I was on recruiting in Chicago, I was asked to pick up the 9th District Commander at the airport, who flew in from Cleveland to go speak at some event in Chicago. And you know, recruiters, we all had to do some duty driver stuff every now and then. So I said, okay, it's my turn to go do it. My chief, who was my officer in charge, was really, really proud of me about my working on my education, being successful as a recruiter. And he wanted to go along because he wanted to meet the admiral. So we picked the admiral up at the airport, and we get in the car and we're driving downtown Chicago. And my chief, Rich Longcar, chief bosun mate, another bosun mate.
That's well typical. Yeah, I said strong chief leaders. Right. I mean, that's
we knew that going in.
So Chief Longcar probably tells the district commander. He said, and I'm gonna tell you who the district commander is here later. Says Petty Officer Patton is working on his master's degree, and the admiral sitting in the back says, "Oh, really?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And so then the admiral says, "Well, when are you going to OCS?" And then I proudly respond, "Well, I'm not, sir. I want to be Master Chief of the Coast Guard someday."
Yeah. I bet that BMC was beaming with pride.
Well, no, he wasn't.
No.
Well,
the admiral's like, "What are you telling this guy?"
It was the wrong answer at the time.
And that's kind of what happened, because the chief, like I told you, the guy was extremely proud of me. And so he just kind of like, he hits me in the rib, you know? and I said, "Wow, what was that for?" And then the admiral sitting in the back seat gets quiet, doesn't say another word to me. So we drop the admiral off, and then as we get back in the car, the Chief Longcar says, "You know, you got to quit telling people about this want to be Master Chief of the Coast Guard." He said, "Look, I'm proud of you. I hope you get to be it one day, but you got to quit telling people that, because they think you're being an asshole and they think you're being a smart ass." I said, no, he asked me. I gave him an answer. He said, "Next time, tell people you're working on. You're putting your package together. That you're colorblind. Tell them anything. Don't tell them, because they're not going to believe you." So I said, all right, chief. So I said, okay, I let it go. So then fast forward. Now later, I get transferred to Cleveland. The district commander in Cleveland becomes the commandant of the Coast Guard, and he's in Washington, D.C. So I'm in Cleveland. In fact, we didn't cross paths. By the time I got to Cleveland, he was already gone. So when I get to Cleveland, and I'm there about, so maybe it was a little more than a year, about a year and a month or something like that. I come to work one morning, and it was probably about a year and a half. I come to work one morning, and then my commander calls me into his office. And I says, "Yes, sir." He says, "Have a seat."
Uh-oh.
At my desk.
Oh, at my desk. Oh, this is great.
At the desk, sir? He says, yeah, because you're going to get a phone call, and I want you to take the call. You know, you take it there at my desk. I says, well, who am I going to call from? He says, I'll be honest with you. When I got the call, I didn't believe who it was either, but I'm going to tell you. I says, you're going to get a call from the Commandant of the Coast Guard. And I said, the Commandant? He says, yeah. And then it dawned on me. Well, yeah, I met him when I was in Chicago. And then he says, yeah. He says, well, he wants to talk to you. And I said, oh, shit. I mean, what did I do?
Yeah, right.
I said, you know, that guy that pissed off at me that waited till he was Commandant to call me up and bitch me out.
Oh, man, that'd be vindictive, wouldn't it?
So I'm thinking that's what the case is. So anyway, the phone rings, and, you know, I answer the phone, and it says, yeah, this is Admiral Gracie. And I said, yes, sir. He says, are you the Patton I met in Chicago a few years ago? And I says, yes, sir. He says, you still want to be Master Chief of the Coast Guard someday? And I says, yes, sir. And then I'm thinking to myself,
is this a true story or a C story, Master Chief? Come on. Yeah.
This is a true story. Yeah. This is a true story. This is a very true story. So I'm thinking this guy is telling me this, like, oh, man, he's the friggin' Commandant. He's going to make me the Commandant. He's going to make me the Master Chief of Coast Guard. You know, I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to go from first class to Master Chief, just like that, you know. But then he says, well, you know, I'm working on changing the officer in the enlisted evaluation system. And we picked an officer. And then I asked to get somebody to do the enlisted system. They paraded a whole bunch of officers in front of me. And then I told them, why can't I have an enlisted person? And the answer was, well, there's no qualified enlisted person. And then he told the project officer, well, I met this guy named Patton in Chicago. Go find him. And that's how
that's
how it
awesome.
So,
wow. Yeah.
Wow.
So I get transferred.
Just goes to show you got to take those duty driver assignments seriously, right? You never
know.
You
never know. So I get transferred to Washington, D.C. For the sole purpose of to do my doctorate degree on the development and the implementation of the Coast Guard enlisted evaluation system. So that very enlisted evaluation system that you guys were bitching and moaning about, who's a fool that wrote that, you're talking to him.
Oh, man. Interview over. That's good.
So it was a real chance of a lifetime, and I became the first enlisted person from any military service to get selected to go to graduate school. So I got my doctorate at American University, and developed the enlisted evaluation system. And then after that was done, I made chief while I was at headquarters, and then I got orders, and I went back to sea. And I went to the Coast Guard Cutter Boutwell as a YNC. And then from there, I did 3 years on Boutwell.
Were you the command chief on the Boutwell, Master Chief? Or?
Yes, I later became command chief on the Boutwell.
Okay.
About my last 8 months, I became a command chief on the Boutwell. And then after the Boutwell, I made senior chief while I was on Boutwell.
Hey, we're talking a lot of chief. Just for our listeners that don't know, can you explain what a command chief does? We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done.
Oh, yes. Okay, so the command chief is the senior enlisted advisor to the commanding officer. Typically, it's the senior most chief or senior chief or even master chief that's on the ship, but that's not always the reason. Like the commanding officer can pick whoever he or she wants that's at least an E7 to be the senior enlisted advisor on the ship. So like in my last 7 or 8 months that I was on Boutwell, my captain selected me to be the senior enlisted advisor. And what that role was pretty much was being it kind of followed into pretty much when I changed my raid and working with people and so forth to be sort of the conduit between the command and the crew to report to the command when I saw things that were any concerns or issues and so forth. I would link very closely with who the district command master chief was at the time, and be at functions and so forth. It's sort of like the senior enlisted, representing the senior enlisted for the
very
for
political the answer.
Come on, Master Chief, admit it. Just like your boot camp company commander said, you told the CO what to do. Just like the MCPOC told the commandant what to do.
I always think you tell him what he did wrong.
Right.
You know what I mean? You're doing it wrong right now.
If you were to interview Captain Cecil Allison, who was my last commanding officer on Boutwell, I think he would tell you exactly that. Yeah, he told me what to do.
That's good.
So after my tour on Boutwell, and I made senior chief, I actually put in to do something else. I wanted to stay out in Seattle because I wanted to work over at the PERSRU, or the Personnel Reporting Unit, which they've got a new name now, SPO, whatever.
SPO, SPO.
Yeah. So, but headquarters said, well, no, you know what? You actually owe us because that doctorate degree you got, you really need to do a tour to pay back your education. I said, well, I thought when I went to graduate school, it was for doing the evaluation system.
Should be like, you need me to duty drive anybody?
Yeah. So long story short to that was they wanted somebody to do evaluation of all of the enlisted training programs. And I was probably well suited for it because as I was working on developing the enlisted evaluation system, I got to learn a lot about all of the ratings throughout the Coast Guard. So I was kind of suited to do the training evaluations and so forth. So I was sent back to headquarters as a senior chief, which was a great job. I worked with every rating in the Coast Guard on looking at both A schools, C school requirements, any special skills and so forth.
And this was back when you could actually like get into the headquarters building, right? Like it wasn't.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, wasn't quite Fort Knox yet.
Exactly, that's right. Yeah.
Hey, Master Chief, on the Boutwell, Bill can help me out. The cutter. Are you a shellback? Did you ever cross the line? Did you do any of that stuff?
We crossed the date line, so I did become a shellback.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious. Yeah. Getting the pedigree, I guess. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And when I was on Dallas, I crossed the equator as well. So yeah.
All right. Nice. So we're back we're in headquarters, the Puzzle Palace, doing your
training evaluation. I did that.
What were the results of that? Were they positive?
Oh yeah, they were positive. Yeah. What came out of that? It really was a lot of things that when I became Master Chief of the Coast Guard, I was able to implement a lot of things that I suggested that never went anywhere. And
nice.
I can talk about that
yep.
a little later. Good. So yeah, it really set. I'll be honest with you, that job really set me up. That if I ever became Master Chief of the Coast Guard, things that didn't get done that I wanted to get done, I was able to get done, and it really did. So for example, as I was looking at on a lot of the trainings. Requirements was changing some of the qualification codes on different types of specialties of jobs that were done that later translated to qualification for special duty assignment pay. So I kind of wrote a multitude of things as well as made recommendations to program managers of how they should take a better look at bosun mate rating. I advocated for the need for strengthening the striker program for bosun mates, which at the time it was either go to A school or a striker. In fact, back then I don't think anybody went to A school for bosun mate school back then, but it was really a push to try to strengthen a formalized training for bosun mates and so forth, as well as looking at the boarding officer program, which I had always felt a long time ago that it should eventually build into a which we now have the maritime enforcement specialist rating. And I didn't recommend that as a whole, but I recommended that the Coast Guard should get serious about with the amount of law enforcement that we're doing and the requirements, regulatory and so forth, that the Coast Guard needs to get serious about looking at putting together a full rating, because my concern had been all along, just going back to when I didn't want to go on recruiting duty because I was going to be pulled out of my rating, but yet I still had to compete for the service wide, is that we had some of the greatest maritime law enforcement specialists that were MKs, BMs, et cetera, and so forth. They were great at this, but when it comes to taking the service wide exam, you know, none of that's on their test.
I'm going to think that you were like, man, these poor boss mates out there just locking up all kinds of evildoers really shouldn't have to do the paperwork. So right. We should make a whole rating that has to do the paperwork for them. Right. That's the way I'd frame it.
You should have been on my staff. You would have said this much better for me. That said, is that in that training evaluation role that I did, yeah, it really set me up, you know, when I became Master Chief of the Coast Guard to do that. So I made Master Chief, and then I went off to, I first went off to the Sergeant's Major Academy, which was great. I wanted to do that because I had talked with Coasties who had gone through that program, and I wanted to do some kind of a joint service type assignment, because I felt then that particularly as I looked at later, at even if I didn't become Master Chief of the Coast Guard, and if I got into a command Master Chief job and so forth, that it really would be awesome to have a job that you work with other services. So went to Sergeant Major's Academy, which was 6 months long.
Where was that one at, Master Chief? Where did they?
El Paso, Texas.
El Paso, yeah.
Yeah, I tell you what, you know, El Paso, Texas, I hated it.
Really? It wasn't as cold as Detroit?
Very different than Detroit, that's for sure.
It's like living on the moon, man. I mean, you know, it was like living on the moon with air. It's ugly. It's just barren. It's just nasty. And all the Army did, the Army made me realize I picked the best service ever. I had fun. I did. I had fun, because one of the cool things about particularly, and to tell any of you listeners out there, if you ever think about going into, you know, going to the Sergeant Major's Academy and so forth, as a Coastie, you will be great, because every Coastie that goes through that school, it's a very complex, comprehensive school, but every Coastie always comes out in the top 10% of the class. You know why? Because, see, we take tests for advancement. So we're used to studying for service-wide and stuff like that. The Army guys, they never do any of that. And then they go to the school, they got to learn how to study.
Read, and I think, like, is what you meant to say, Master Chief. They have to learn how to read.
Say it.
They got to friggin' read, you know.
He said it.
And it was like a piece of cake for me, not because of my education. I mean, every coach who's gone through there will tell you that, yeah, it's a piece of cake, but they look at their Army buddies, they're all sweating in it and everything, you know. So I had a blast there. It was fun, and I got to wear Army BDUs for 6 months. They called me Walking Seaweed.
Walking Seaweed. I knew there had to be some kind of nickname. Yeah.
So I went to jump school. So then when I went to jump school, then I became the Flying Seaweed.
Hey, that's an added benefit right there. Yeah. I mean, why not? Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome.
So, you know, and I became one of the few Coasties that, as a result of going to jump school, I got my wings.
Very cool. And, yeah. You're like, I'm never going to use these, right, but they look good on my uniform.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah. So I got.
What do you, Master Chief? What do you learn there? Like, what's the? I'm just.
It's
the enlisted answer, though. You got to give us the enlisted answer.
Yeah, I'm trying to, because it is kind of common. It's about strategy. It's about it's not as much about leadership as it is about management. It's about about strategic planning, looking at running a service, a force, and what do you need to run with it in terms of dollars and cents and bullets and, you know, and bagels and all kinds of stuff. It's pretty complex. It's Army specific, of course, but you can translate that in terms of knowing how to do things in the Coast Guard on a much smaller scale. That's why it was somewhat of a laughable program. Let's see that the Army has to have 100 people to do one job.
We have one person to do 100 jobs.
Yep.
Right, exactly. So, but it was, I just think that because it was so different, you could still translate those kinds of things into what you can do in the Coast Guard. So I did learn an awful lot. And it also helped me when I got up into that level, when I became a Command Master Chief, that, you know, I could speak that language with my admiral. I mean, you know, when the admirals are sitting down there and they're playing with the with the game board of moving ships here and there and what it takes to do that. And
was there really a game board? Is there a game board at headquarters, Master Chief?
Actually, there was. I don't know if there still is, but there was at the time when I was there.
That's cool. I hope we still have one of those. If I was making decisions, I'd want the game board. You know what I mean?
There was a game board.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, big things, like, for example, when you wanted to build an immediate fort operating base, what does it take to put there, you know, in terms of people and resources? See, I learned all that in the Sergeant Major's Academy, so I was able to sit there and have that conversation with all of these guys, you know, all of these admirals and generals and other, not just flag officers, but senior officers. I was up there with them. I'm able to have that conversation with them, which kind of really freaked them out that, you're not supposed to know this kind of stuff. Well, you know what I do? And I know it probably a little better than you think I do.
Yeah, I can see me and Bill are standing in front of the game board, and we move one cutter from Atlant to PAC, and we're like, all right, done. And you're like, there's a little more to it than that. I can see it.
So after Sergeant Major's Academy, I got a job as the senior enlisted advisor to Joint Task Force 160, which was a joint service assignment. I worked for a four-star Marine Corps general, General Sheehan, and during that time we had a military operation Support Democracy, which was the largest alien migration Cubans and Haitians that were trying to get into the United States, and the fact that in addition to using Coast Guard assets, other military service assets were also used. So it all that fell under the command of what was then called the U.S. Atlantic Command, which was run by General Sheehan, and I was his senior enlisted advisor. So here I am with Coastie, and I'm walking the halls with everybody else. It was funny too, because I was sent down to Haiti to work down there in Haiti and so forth, and I'm working around with these Army guys. So I would put on my BDUs and I'd be around. So I got so I'm a Master Chief, and I got, you know, with the two stars, and these guys would be saluting me because they think I'm a general.
Oh yeah, right. Oh yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
So you were on the ground in Haiti during the migration?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was. Okay. Yep, I was down. I was down there and also over in, and then I switched locations over to Gitmo. They put me over in Haiti for about 5.5 months, and I think another 6 months I was over in Gitmo. So they switched me over there. And from there I got selected as Atlantic Area Command Master Chief, where I worked for Admiral Loy, who was the Atlantic Area Commander at the time. And then he becomes Commandant of the Coast Guard, and he picks me as his Master Chief of the Coast Guard. So that's kind of how that whole cycle came about. In about 3 hours of you asking me this.
No, that was
that's awesome. An hour a decade, yeah. So we're not doing bad there, really.
So when when Admiral Loy interviews you for the job, right? Did he interview you, or I mean, he already knew you pretty well, and.
Oh yeah, he interviewed me. Oh yeah, he interviewed me as well as he interviewed four other people. But I'd be honest with you, even though I worked for him on two occasions, because when I was working in headquarters on training evaluation, he was a one star. He was chief of personnel at the time. So I had worked with him on two occasions. It's nice that the fact that I had a familiarity with him. But I'll also tell you that.
You had dirt on him. You had dirt on him, right?
That's yeah. Well, I learned that when you got to be the Commandant of the Coast Guard, you got different priorities. And so picking your Master Chief was not as much as the familiarity of somebody that you knew. It had more to do with what is your priorities are, you know, what's your agenda and how do you fit with that agenda. So the people he picked that to be interviewed, all of us were pretty much right within that agenda of what he wanted. So I mean, any one of us could have gotten picked. That I certainly didn't look at it that I was a shoe-in. I mean, I to be honest with you, I really didn't think I was. I thought he had enough of me.
What's, you know, I'm just surprised that like nobody back in the past was like, one day you're going to be Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard, and then you would have been golden. You know what I mean? Like it would have definitely right. came. It would have happened. No, that's awesome, Master Chief. How was it testifying before Congress? And I mean, is it as nerve wracking as I would think it is?
It's nerve wracking in preparation. Easiest pie when you do it. When I say preparation, because you know, no one sits before Congress until they get a written testimony, whether you read from the testimony or not. Crossing the T's and dotting the I's, and the people you have to go through to get that done, that was frustrating. I mean, I know what I wanted to say. I know how I wanted to say it. I kind of prided myself on I was a good writer and so on, but it didn't matter. It's because other people got their hands on it, and you know, well, you should say it this way, you should say it that way. But in the end, when you get past the written testimony, and then all of a sudden you're sitting there, and you know, and your 5 minutes of talking to your to the committees was there. You can say any damn thing you want.
Yeah, you shoot from the hip, do whatever, huh?
and that's what I did. I mean, that's kind of.
You just had to wait out all the editors, and then you're golden.
That's right. Yeah,
that's good.
That's right. And you know, and it took me the first time to do it. For the first time, you know, I went this. I said, "Oh man, this is bullshit. I'm not going to do this. You know, I really don't like doing this." So, and then I talked to my predecessors, and they all said, "Look, just do whatever they ask. When your time comes, you say whatever you want to say." So I said, okay, you know, so I went through it, and they were right. You know, when the time came and it was my turn, and it was kind of loose and free-flowing. I had a five-minute opening speech and then sit there and answer questions. And so what I always did, because I always would testify after the commandant, is that I took notes from what he talked about so I could come and be sort of his counterpart to that, because you know, to the most part, to the congressmen and so forth, it's one thing to tell them about what the state of health of the people. They might listen to you and so forth, but they really are there have to do with putting a check mark on how much money the Coast Guard budget is going to be. So I had to pay attention to what was important on our budget to make things happen, which, of course, 90% of that had to deal with people. Right. So, but I always looked at what the commandant had to struggle with to be able to articulate that. And once I was able to do that, and that's how Admiral Loy and I kind of really worked very well together as a result of that, because he found it pretty easy for me to be, you know, the guy, because he was kind of more handcuffed. He could kind of say what he want, but, and again, he couldn't, you know.
He was commissioned and you were enlisted. Right. Yeah.
That's right.
Enough said.
Exactly.
We got it. You can fly off the handle on occasion, and
right.
It might not be okay, but it's expected.
Everybody kind of expects a Master Chief to yell every now and again, but not
exactly,
so much for
exactly.
the Admiral.
Exactly. So, you know, so I was able to, you know, be a little bit more open about it. I mean, respectful, but a little bit more open about things and what I said and so forth. And it was very appreciative of the fact that I was able to do that. And it, as some of the congressmen and senators, you know, probably the best compliment I ever got was when I testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Senator McCain was chairman of that committee. The best compliment I ever got was from him when I talked solely about what our people in the Coast Guard, how long we were working, the kind of equipment we were using, you know, the fact that we were magicians trying to work on things that was 50 years old and things along those lines, and you know, and so forth. And he said to me, after, he says, you know, Master Chief, this is the first time that you ever brought this down to a level that I can understand and my colleagues will understand better to be able to look at the Coast Guard's budget. And that right there, I said, well, that's the best compliment I ever got.
Yeah, know? Heck yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
awesome. Even though he's a senator from Arizona, and obviously you don't like the Southwest. Right? Yeah, I think we got that out of El Paso. No, that's great, Master Chief. Hey, I'll ask you a parting shot. What was the craziest thing you ever saw when you were the Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard? Anything weird in D.C.? Anything?
Yes. The answer is yes to that.
I knew there would be something.
I got a lot of stories. But this one, I'm going to end on a very, very serious note, and I think it's important to tell you the story when you use the term weird. So 9/11 occurs. Okay, and of course we all know that story, what went on and so forth. So within a matter of days after 9/11, Admiral Loy and I fly up to New York to go look at the operation, as well as we go to Ground Zero. We actually got to go to all three Ground Zeros, the one at the Pentagon, the one out in Pennsylvania, as well as the one in New York. So we're walking around in the Ground Zero area of New York, probably maybe 5 or 6 days after the event. So things are still smoldering. The smell, the stench, it was just horrible. So we, and the fact that both Admiral Loy and I were very familiar with New York, having both been stationed at Governor's Island, we walk around in certain parts and we come to the graveyard of the Trinity Church, which was located just a few short blocks from where the World Trade Center towers were. And obviously, as you know, they were reduced to rubble. In the graveyard, some of the names of Coast Guard cutters, or like Gallatin, Spencer, Hamilton, were buried in that graveyard. Admiral Loy looked over and looked at the graveyard, and particularly looked at Hamilton's gravesite, and you know, debris all over it and so forth. And then he and I both looked at the church where the graveyard was. The church was pretty much untouched, other than just debris around it and one broken window. Now, everything around that church was demolished, wiped out completely. This church stood still by itself, at the Trinity Church, and this graveyard. So Admiral Loy says to me, looks at me, and with a tear in his eye, you know, looks at me and he says, "I want you to get a work party together, and come over and clean up the graveyard. I want that graveyard cleaned up as soon as possible." And I kind of looked at him a little strange, because I'm thinking, there's a lot of other things going on here, Admiral. I mean, clean up a graveyard, somehow I don't think that's priority one, but you know what, you're the commandant, I'll do whatever you want. You know, that's kind of, I said to myself. So I contact the command senior chief, who was at Sector New York, and I told him what the Admiral wanted. And, you know, and he says, "Master Chief, you know how much work that is? Because, I mean, there was like girders. To clean that place up was going to take weeks, if not months, not to mention everything else that's going on around there." So I said, "Look, I know, Senior Chief, but, you know, this is what the old man wants. And let's do what we can. Make a big, strong, concerted effort to do as much as you can. I know it's hard to get people because, you know, Sector New York was stretched thin and so forth. And anyway, he got about a dozen people and went over to the grave site the next day. And 3 days later, he calls me up, and I'm back in Washington. And the senior chief calls me up and says, "Can you get up here to New York like right now? Like, can you get here by the end of the day?" And you know, now they shut down flights, you know, so the only way I could ever get up there was either drive, or I could get either Coast Guard or National Guard helicopter to take me up there. So I says, "Is this important? I got to be." So, "Yeah, you got to come up here. There's no way I can explain this to you. You have to be here." And I says, "Okay." So I I go to the commandant to get permission to contact the Army National Guard to get a helicopter to fly me up to New York. And you know, I get to New York, and the senior chief and a few other folks are there waiting for me. I said, "What's so urgent? What do you need me up here?" He says, "Listen, Matthew, there's no way I can explain this to you over the phone. You've got to see this." So I says, "Okay." So we go over to Trinity Church. 3 days after I was there, the place is spotless. There is nothing other than just the grave sites all cleaned, the church all clean, the window that was broken replaced. Now there was piled high, like maybe a story or two high, of plastic bags of debris, because all of the debris was considered a crime scene stuff that it couldn't throw it away. But this place was, I thought, well, how the hell did you guys do this? I mean, it's, you told me it's like 12 of you did this. He says, this is what happened. He says, so we got over there and we started working. And as soon as we started working, all the other workers, everybody else that was around, saw what we were doing. They stopped whatever they were doing. And then they all came over to the churchyard and everybody pitched in. He says, at one time, Matthew, I couldn't even see the ground with all of the people that were there cleaning this place up. And they brought in heavy equipment loaders. They did all this stuff. And for the most part, nobody spoke a word during this whole time it happened. And then, you know, and they made this place spotless. And I like, wow. I mean, you want to talk about how divine intervention works of sorts. That's probably the best way I could really describe it, because it was a miracle. It really was. It was a true miracle compared to what I saw 3 days earlier. And there was no living way that I could even guess that they could have that done inside 72 hours, if not 72 days at the earliest that I thought could be done. Which is why I kind of protested the whole fact of doing that, because it was tying up our people for a very long time to do that. But it was done in 3 days, and it was just amazing.
Yeah, and I'm sure Admiral Loy, you know, had his reasons, and you know, I'm sure completely meaningful to tons of people that were around that site, and then to see that and to see you guys working on it, and then with the you know, the founder of our service being buried there. You know, what an amazing respect to show him and others.
Well, you know, and it's kind of like that, because Admiral Loy, and he wrote that in his book Character in Action. You actually see there's a little section we talked about this. Was that why he made me do it, to have this done, was it was just nothing but death, destruction, and the feeling of being defeated. And you have to walk ground zero to understand that meaning about feeling of being defeated. And what can you do outside of the fact of, you know, launching an aircraft or whatever to go, you know, find and kick Bin Laden's ass or whatever the case may be, to do those kinds of things. But what can you immediately do that gives you sense and purpose and pride of what this country is all about? And that's what came to his mind. And he says, you know, if there's nothing else that, in the true sense of God and country, we're going to clean up this graveyard. We're going to make this church be the focal point to all of the things that went wrong around it to make it right. And that's what happened.
Very cool.
Great,
like
story,
you said,
sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Impactful story there at the end.
For sure.
Master Chief, we thank you so much for your time today. You know, what an amazing career you had. And amazing lessons learned for everybody that's listening. So thank you. Thank you really for sharing your time with us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Master Chief. It's really an honor is the only word I can use. It was an honor talking to you.
Well, thank you, Phil and Bill. Thank you both so much for inviting me to speak, and as well as giving me the rein to talk the way I talk about this thing. But I'm excited. I'm just excited about, you know, not just the wonderful career that I've had, but the people who have served, more importantly, in the fact that continuing on in this aspect of what you're doing with continuing to tell the Coast Guard story, and that's very important. And I understand both of you are very involved with the building of the National Coast Guard Museum, and I thank you both for your involvement of doing that. And this is why we have to tell our story, because we have a phenomenal service. And no matter what any of us have done in the Coast Guard, be it something very little to whatever might be large or great or whatever the case may be, all in all, just the supreme pride and our feeling of what Semper Paratus means to us is telling that story to our American public. And with your role with this podcast, you're doing that. And I can't thank you both enough for doing this.
Hey, we appreciate it, Master Chief. Hey, where can people find you now? What are you into these days? What's the, you know, anything that we can steer people so they can find out more about you?
Well, as I always tell everybody, I will never make it in the witness protection program.
No, you will not. No, you will not.
I'm the easiest guy to find. So I got my hands in a lot of pies. Right now, my paying job is I'm senior vice president for leadership development for a company called New Day USA, which is a mortgage company based in the Washington, D.C. area. I pretty much run leadership development programs for the company, which is pretty cool. So it's what I've done in the Coast Guard, and I've kind of translated that into civilian terms. And then I do a lot of philanthropic things. I'm on the board of directors for the National Coast Guard Museum. I'm also chairman of the board of trustees for a tiny two-year college, Northeast Maritime Institute, which is located up in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. And I'm currently president of the Non-Commissioned Officers Association. So I stay busy, stay active. People can easily find me on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'm pretty easy to find on any of those things, and would love to hear from anybody. Like I said, I'm very easy to find. So track me down, drop me a note. I'll be happy to respond back to you.
Hey, awesome, Master Chief. Great. Again, thank you so much. And if we can ever do anything for you going forward with the podcast, you just let us know and we're there.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it. And yes, I will be calling on you guys sometime in the future, that as we get a little closer to our goal on the National Coast Guard Museum, to ask you folks to probably do a little special on our Coast Guard Museum program. So,
oh, for I know sure. You hey, how cool is it going to be to take our kids and family to the National Coast Guard Museum? You know, once it's built, it's going to be so cool. Yeah,
it is. It actually will be. It actually will be.
Hey, Master Chief, thanks for your time. Thanks for your service, and thanks for your stories.
All right, guys. Well, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it.
Great. Thanks,
sir. Take care, Master Chief. Thank you.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform, and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.